It appeared from these studies that a powerful case had been made that damage to the neurons that use acetylcholine for a transmitter is a key element in Alzheimer's-type dementia. Based on this idea, studies were then conducted using drugs that would increase acetylcholine concentrations in the brains of patients suffering from Alzheimer's dementia. The results of these studies were disappointing, even though brain acetylcholine levels were measurably higher after the drugs were given. In some studies, memory did improve in a few of these patients, but they continued to deteriorate as before. But there were problems with the theory as well. First of all, it didn't explain the selective death of glutamate neurons in the brain. In part, this could be explained by the finding that the neurons in the basal nucleus of Meynert, that controls the brain's acetylcholine system, can be destroyed by injecting powerful excitotoxins into the area. That is, these special nuclei contain glutamate-type neurons. This would explain why this nucleus is destroyed in the majority of cases of Alzheimer's disease. There were other problems with this theory, however, that are not so easily explained. For example, it is known that in another neurological disease, the nucleus of Meynert, thought to be the primary site of injury in Alzheimer's dementia, is also destroyed, yet these patients do not suffer from significant dementia. Also, some Alzheimer's patients have normal levels of the enzyme CAT in their cortex. Apparently, the acetylcholine system plays only a part in this disease. The hitmen of Alzheimer's disease. We now know that within the brain there exists a whole network of neurons that use glutamate, MSG is a sodium salt of glutamate, as their transmitter. All of these neurons were found to be excitatory. That is, they excite the brain to activity rather than calm it down. Biochemical examinations of the brains of individuals dying with Alzheimer's disease indicate that large numbers of glutamate-type neurons are specifically destroyed. For example, in the cortex of Alzheimer's patients, over 35% to 40% of all glutamate receptor neurons are destroyed. But remember, there are three types of glutamate receptors, called NMDA, quisqualate, and kinate. Over 60% of the NMDA-type glutamate receptor neurons are destroyed in Alzheimer's brains. Perhaps these specific neurons are reduced in number because most of the neurons die in the cortex as a result of this disease. But if we examine the other neuron cell types that use other transmitters besides glutamate and aspartate, we see that most remain unharmed, even late in the disease. So, whatever is killing these brain cells in Alzheimer's disease, it is targeting, for the most part, very specific types of neurons, neurons that use glutamate and aspartate as a neurotransmitter. When MSG is consumed in large doses or injected into the brain of experimental animals, we see that not all of the neurons are killed or damaged. The toxic effect is very specific. The most frequently killed cells are pyramid-shaped neurons, called pyramidal neurons, which are located in the deeper layers of the cortex. Cells in the nucleus basalis, certain neurons of the hypothalamus, and pyramidal neurons in the hippocampus of the temporal lobes. The distribution of cellular damage caused by large concentrations of MSG is very similar to that seen in human cases of Alzheimer's disease. But we also know that in Alzheimer's disease, other types of neurons are also damaged, that is, cells that use chemicals other than glutamate for their neurotransmitter. As we have seen, the cholinergic neuron, those using acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, are also severely damaged. But these neurons make up only a small portion of the cells in the brain. Most neurons in the cortex and hippocampus affected in Alzheimer's disease use glutamate or aspartate as their neurotransmitter. Previously, I stated that the basal nucleus of Meynert was the nucleus of origin for most of the cholinergic neurons scattered throughout the brain. I also quoted an experiment in which this nucleus suffered destructive lesions. But what is interesting is that these experimental lesions were made using a powerful glutamate receptor toxin called ibotenic acid. It is now known that this critical nucleus contains numerous glutamate receptor neurons. Other experiments have shown that when glutamate is applied to the cortex of the brain, neurons utilizing acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter within the basal nucleus of Meynert die. As a result, all of the cholinergic damage seen with Alzheimer's disease could be explained by selective excitotoxin damage to this nucleus. Thus far, most of the features of the disease seem to fit the excitotoxin hypothesis. Other connections to excitotoxins. When I discussed the other neurodegenerative diseases in the previous chapter, I stated that the final common effect of exposure to large doses of excitotoxic amino acids was the release of free radicals within the neurons triggered by the influx of calcium. A related phenomenon also triggered by calcium is the destructive outpouring of fatty acid compounds within the cells called prostaglandins. If excitotoxins are the primary cause of the neuron death seen in Alzheimer's disease, we would expect to see high levels of free radicals in these brain areas and evidence of prostaglandin activation as well. In one study in which the brains of Alzheimer's patients were examined, it was found that the areas most often affected by the disease demonstrated very high levels of these destructive enzymes and free radicals. It has been demonstrated experimentally that glutamate in toxic doses can greatly increase the levels of destructive lipid products, prostaglandins, and free radicals within the cells. In fact, in tissue culture experiments, vitamin E, a powerful antioxidant, can completely block the toxicity of glutamate. This degree of protection has not been demonstrated in intact animals or humans. The finding of accumulation of very high levels of destructive lipid products, prostaglandin cascade, and free radical formations in the neurons exposed to high concentrations of glutamate may explain an interesting observation reported in the British medical journal Lancet. In this study, a group of doctors examined the records of a large number of rheumatoid arthritis patients and a second population of clinically diagnosed Alzheimer's disease patients, and found that the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in the rheumatoid arthritis patients was below that expected for the age group examined. After studying a multitude of possible causes for this low incidence, they concluded that the cause was a high and prolonged intake of anti-inflammatory drugs by the rheumatoid arthritis patients. In the rare case of rheumatoid arthritis patients having Alzheimer's disease, they found that all had discontinued taking their medications years before. We know that anti-inflammatory drugs not only reduce inflammation, but do so by inhibiting the prostaglandin cascade, the same destructive reactions seen when neurons are exposed to excitotoxins. Another possible mechanism is that the anti-inflammatory drugs could help stabilize the blood-brain barrier so as to prevent toxic doses of glutamate and other excitotoxins from entering the brain. Further evidence for the protective effect of anti-inflammatory medications comes from a recent study appearing in the journal Neurology. This study is even more impressive because elderly twins were used as the test subjects. What makes a study of twins so important is that it eliminates many variables that cannot be controlled for in other population studies. For example, in a twin study, the subjects are the same age, they share the same early life environmental locations, same basic nutrition, and the same exposure to toxins. But most important, they share the same genetic makeup. In this study, they found that those taking anti-inflammatory medications, either as steroids or non-steroid anti-inflammatory medication, had the lowest incidence of Alzheimer's disease. In fact, the best protective effect was seen when steroids were combined with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications. This doesn't mean that they took steroids regularly, but that they had taken them at one time before the onset of the disease in their twin. The authors of the paper concluded that anti-inflammatory medications appear to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease and may even prevent its development. Earlier, I stated that excitotoxins could stimulate the formation of free radicals within exposed neurons. It is also known that free radicals can, in turn, trigger the release of even higher levels of glutamate within the brain, resulting in even greater damage. So we see that the process of destruction, once initiated, becomes self-generating. One fact that we must keep in mind is that most studies demonstrating the toxic effect of glutamate have used it in very high doses. This is because researchers cannot wait 10 or 20 years to observe the effect of prolonged exposure to lower doses. But we do know prolonged exposure of neurons to subtoxic doses, lower than needed to kill neurons, of glutamate, can produce identical changes in the dendrites of neurons seen in cases of typical Alzheimer's disease. Unlike most animal experiments using glutamate or aspartate, which involve short exposures, with human cases of Alzheimer's disease, the exposure to these excitotoxins would be expected to persist over decades, over a lifetime. This is especially true with a large number of foods now containing excitotoxin taste enhancers of various sorts, and with the widespread use of aspartame. It is important to recall that excitotoxin damage is multiplied by the addition of several excitotoxins within one's diet. Glutamate plus aspartate is much more toxic than either one used alone. Many foods contain glutamate, aspartate, and cysteine as hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Most diet colas contain aspartame, with a primary ingredient of aspartate. Another piece of the evidence linking excitotoxins to Alzheimer's disease is the finding that the highest density of neurofibrillary tangles, the characteristic pathological finding in all Alzheimer's cases, is seen in the parts of the brain containing the highest concentration of glutamate-type neurons. Exposing human neurons in tissue culture to aspartate or glutamate can induce the formation of paired helical filaments similar to those seen in neurofibrillary tangles. This is a very important finding because this particular structure is almost exclusively seen in neurodegenerative diseases. The studies of Parkinson ALS dementia complex of Guam demonstrate that chronic exposure of humans and other primates to a plant excitotoxin, BMAA, produce widespread damage to many parts of the nervous system. Of equal interest was the finding that the final stage of the disease produced by the excitotoxin exposure depended on the concentration of the excitotoxin and the duration of exposure. For example, Spencer found that short exposures of high concentrations of the toxin most often produced ALS and Parkinson's disease, whereas more chronic exposures produced dementia. This may explain why glutamate in our food and aspartate can manifest as different diseases, ALS, Parkinson's disease, or Alzheimer's dementia. Another interesting discovery is that as our nervous system ages, our neurons, NMDA-type glutamate neurons, have more difficulty controlling the influx of calcium into the cell. This would mean that as we age, our brain would become more vulnerable to excitotoxin damage. This is why the older we get, the more cautious we should become about eating foods containing excitotoxins, such as MSG and aspartate, NutraSweet. Energy, the key to brain protection. In review, we now know that glutamate, if given in large doses, can kill neurons containing glutamate receptors. For this reason, the brain must have some mechanism to protect itself from high concentrations of glutamate in the blood. It does this by the blood-brain barrier. Previously, it was thought that when this barrier system was working properly, it could protect the brain from even massive concentrations of glutamate and aspartate in the blood. To some extent, this is true. The brain normally contains relatively low concentrations of glutamate and aspartate, which are used as metabolic fuels and as neurotransmitters. Glutamate is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. But the concentration of these excitatory amino acids within the brain must be carefully regulated so as to prevent toxic amounts from building up around the neurons. To prevent this from happening, the brain possesses an elaborate system to prevent glutamate accumulation. It does this by using an energy-dependent pump system that literally pumps excess glutamate found in the fluid circulating around the neuron into surrounding glia cells. Once in the glia cell, the glutamate is deactivated by special enzymes. By carefully controlling the amount of glutamate near the neuron's glutamate receptor, the protective pumps prevent excess stimulation of the neuron. It works sort of like a thermostat in a tropical fish tank. If the water gets too cold or too hot, the fish will die. The thermostat keeps the amount of heat just right. But the thermostat in the fish tank requires electricity to operate. If the power fails, the thermostat also fails and the fish die. The energy-driven pumps in the glia do the same thing. They keep the concentration of glutamate at just the right level, so that the neurons won't die. If this protective system fails because of a lack of energy, glutamate will begin to accumulate and stimulate the receptors on the surface of the cell membrane, allowing calcium to pour into the cell. As a result, the neuron will become overexcited. Also, excess calcium triggers a cascade of destructive reactions that can lead to cell death. Normally, this protective mechanism is very efficient in keeping this from happening, but it requires large amounts of energy to operate efficiently. Fortunately, the neuron has a backup or fail-safe system should excess calcium enter the neuron. Once excess calcium is detected within the neuron, it will begin to pump this excess calcium back out of the cell. Normally, this is a very efficient process, but it too requires large amounts of cellular energy for its operation. So, what can cause energy in the brain to fail? One of the most common causes is hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. The brain uses glucose, a simple sugar, as its primary fuel. In fact, the brain, which weighs only 3 pounds, 2% of the body's weight, consumes over 25% of all of the glucose used in the body. Unfortunately, it cannot store energy, so when this supply of glucose is shut off, the brain quickly begins to fail. This is why some people have difficulty concentrating, or they feel fuzzy-headed shortly after drinking a sweetened drink. The sudden rush of glucose causes their pancreas to secrete a burst of insulin, which in turn drives down their blood glucose. We call this rather common condition reactive hypoglycemia. When hypoglycemia is severe and prolonged, certain parts of the brain begin to die. These are the same areas of the brain destroyed when animals are fed large doses of MSG. At first, this seems illogical. Why should a lack of glucose in the brain cause the very same pattern of brain injury that is seen when large doses of a neurotoxin are given? But when you begin to appreciate the importance of energy supplied by the glucose in maintaining the protective systems that keep high concentrations of glutamate from accumulating around the neurons, it makes sense. It appears that the brain damage caused by severe hypoglycemia is a result of the failure of these protective mechanisms and not from a lack of fuel to the brain cells themselves. The brain cells do not actually starve to death. If we remove brain energy using another method, such as by preventing blood from reaching the brain or by cutting off the brain's oxygen supply, the same excitotoxin pattern of destruction is seen. So it doesn't matter what the cause of the energy failure is, because the result is identical. Glutamate accumulates in the brain in high levels and destroys glutamate-sensitive neurons. This hypothesis can be further tested by seeing if glucose can protect the brain from the effects of excessive glutamate. And, as expected, it works, at least partly. When rats were fed glucose plus large amounts of MSG, the amount of brain damage seen was considerably less than when glucose was denied. This has also been shown in cell cultures. While glucose can markedly reduce the amount of neuron damage caused by high doses of glutamate, the protection is not complete. The cells are still damaged, but much less so than when glucose is absent. What this means is that chronic exposure to high levels of glutamate or aspartate will cause less brain injury when one's diet contains adequate levels of carbohydrates, but the cumulative damage over many years can still be substantial. This energy protection also seems to exist in humans. The defenders of MSG safety frequently cite a study in which human volunteers were fed large doses of MSG combined with a mixed meal of protein and carbohydrates. Only 10% developed a headache. Most were unaffected. But when the study was repeated using 14 human volunteers, this time keeping the subjects without food overnight, all developed headaches, tightness in the chest, and other symptoms of neurological toxicity related to MSG. So merely going without food overnight can greatly increase the toxicity of MSG. In another study involving 1,529 persons, it was found that 25% developed adverse symptoms after eating foods containing MSG. Children have been reported to develop shudder attacks, shivers, and migraine-like syndromes, which stopped when MSG was eliminated from the diet. While the brain may be able to use some fatty acids for fuel to obtain its energy, the primary fuel for the brain is glucose, a type of simple sugar. The nervous system's appetite for this sugar is voracious. Under normal conditions, the brain absorbs twice as much glucose as it uses. This offers a large measure of protection under conditions where the brain's energy needs are greatly increased, such as with seizures and during the early stages of brain injury. But unlike other tissues in the body, the brain is unable to store energy. When its glucose supply runs out, the brain dies, or at least specific parts will. As we have seen, the loss of cells under conditions of extreme hypoglycemia resembles brain damage caused by MSG. It is known that not all areas of the brain transport and consume glucose at the same rate. For example, the hippocampus has a much narrower margin between its supply and its needs than does the cerebellum. This means that when glucose supplies are low, it is the hippocampus that is injured first and most severely. In fact, the cerebellum is quite resistant to hypoglycemia. We often see this demonstrated in cases of uncontrolled seizures, where the brain is consuming enormous amounts of energy, frequently exceeding its glucose supply, thereby resulting in brain damage. The brain of a person dying with uncontrollable seizures consistently shows severe damage in the hippocampus, but sparing of the cerebellum. So we see that the brain supply of glucose is very critical. It appears that the death of these cells is the result not of starvation, but rather a hypersensitivity to excitotoxins. Under such conditions of insufficient energy supply, even low doses of glutamate and aspartate can kill neurons. This is because the cell's protective mechanisms require large amounts of energy to work. When energy supplies are low, excitotoxins open the calcium channels for much longer periods of time, and as a result, destructive reactions are triggered that will eventually kill the neurons. It has been shown that patients with Alzheimer's disease consistently demonstrate low metabolism in certain parts of their brain, particularly in the parietal lobes and temporal lobes. This has been most dramatically demonstrated with the PET scanner, which displays metabolism of the brain in living subjects. It gives us an ongoing picture of the brain's metabolism during thinking, anger, sleeping, and other everyday conditions. It may have occurred to you that the decreased metabolism is to be expected since these areas of the brain are dying. Dead and injured brain, after all, doesn't require much energy. But at least one study has shown that even before any pathological changes or clinical impairment has taken place, there is substantial slowing of the brain's metabolism of glucose in these areas. We also know that the brain's metabolism, as measured by PET scanning, does not decline with normal aging. Is Alzheimer's disease caused by energy failure of the brain? There is growing evidence that it plays at least a major part in the story. For the brain to receive an adequate amount of glucose on a constant basis, three conditions are necessary. First, glucose must be absorbed from the intestines and enter the blood. Second, the glucose in blood must be transported across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. And finally, the brain cells must be able to convert the glucose into usable energy, primarily ATP. Getting glucose to the brain. In 1983, Dr. Gösta Bucht and co-workers, working at the Department of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Umeå in Sweden, made a most remarkable observation. They found that out of 839 demented patients studied, only 63 were diabetic, and none of these had Alzheimer's disease. They all had dementia of other causes. Statistically, you would expect at least one Alzheimer's patient to have diabetes in this age group. They then studied the Alzheimer's patients to see how they responded when given a high concentration of glucose with a glucose tolerance test. The patient is given 100 grams of glucose as a drink, after which blood glucose and insulin levels are determined on an hourly basis for 6 hours. These Alzheimer's patients' responses were then compared to patients having vascular dementia due to multiple strokes, vascular disease without dementia, and normal, healthy elderly persons. They found that Alzheimer's patients had lower fasting glucose blood levels than did the control patients, but the same insulin levels. But following the glucose challenge, the Alzheimer's patients had significantly lower glucose levels and higher insulin levels than did the control patients. The study seemed to suggest that diabetes and Alzheimer's disease never coexist in the same patient, and that Alzheimer's patients demonstrated reactive hypoglycemia. A similar study was repeated in 1991 by Dr. Yoshikatsu Fujisawa and his associates in Japan. While they did not find lower blood glucose levels in the Alzheimer's patients while fasting, they did see significantly lower glucose levels and higher insulin levels after the glucose drink. And, as in the previous study, they did not see these changes in other types of dementia or in normal control patients. In this study, Dr. Fujisawa also measured the level of insulin in the cerebrospinal fluid of these individuals and found that Alzheimer's patients have significantly higher levels of insulin than was seen in dementia of other causes. These high cerebrospinal fluid insulin levels were seen even before the glucose drink was given. So, what do these findings mean? It could indicate that persons destined to develop Alzheimer's disease have an abnormal response to simple sugars in their diet. That is, they have reactive hypoglycemia. Since insulin has to pass through the blood-brain barrier, it could also mean that in Alzheimer's disease, this barrier is impaired. This would not only allow insulin to enter the brain, but would also allow glutamate and aspartate from the diet to enter as well. As we have seen, when brain cells are starved for glucose, they become extremely vulnerable to destruction by excitotoxins such as MSG. In fact, even normal levels of glutamate can damage energy-deficient neurons. And as we have learned, a typical diet of processed foods contains enormously high levels of MSG and similar excitotoxins. Frequently, the elderly are left to prepare their own food. In today's world of prepared dinners and packaged meals, it is much easier for the elderly to eat these foods than to prepare their meals from scratch. This puts them at high risk of being exposed to large amounts of food additive excitotoxins. it is important to remember that following a meal containing MSG, the blood level of glutamate remains high for at least 3 hours. This would mean that after 3 spaced-out meals, a person's blood glutamate level would remain high all day long and well into the night. Under such conditions, this glutamate could continuously leak through the impaired blood-brain barrier, flooding the energy-impaired and hypersensitive brain with extra glutamate. The glucose transporter system of the brain. Because of the brain's voracious appetite for glucose, a mechanism is needed that will continuously supply this simple sugar to neurons. Glucose cannot simply diffuse across the blood-brain barrier. Rather, it has to be escorted across. The blood-brain barrier, remember, is primarily formed by tightly fitting vascular cells, endothelial cells, excluding certain substances within the blood from easily entering the brain's interior space. Within these endothelial cells, there exists a system to transport glucose to the other side of the vessel wall, allowing it to enter the fluid space around the cells of the brain. This escort system, called the glucose transporter, does not require energy to operate and is very specific for glucose. The transporter system is very efficient when you consider that the microvessels feeding the brain make up only 1% of the brain's weight, yet supply glucose for the entire brain. Equally impressive is the fact that the glucose transporter can deliver 10 times its weight in glucose every minute. The survival of the brain is entirely dependent on this transporter system. Should it malfunction, the brain can become deficient in energy supply and ultimately die as a result. Does this glucose transporter system malfunction in Alzheimer's disease? The answer appears to be yes. When the microvessels from the brains of persons dying with Alzheimer's disease were examined, it was found that they contained significantly less glucose transporter than did the microvessels from normal brains in persons of the same age. Other studies have confirmed these findings. It appears that damage to the brain's glucose transporting system is specifically related to Alzheimer's disease. Clinical studies have shown that the degree of dementia is closely correlated to the degree of metabolic malfunctioning of the brain's cortex. That is, when glucose metabolism and energy production are impaired in specific brain regions, one sees all of the typical findings of Alzheimer's disease: memory loss, disorientation, etc. Once a person begins to develop severe dementia, each additional decline in glucose metabolism greatly magnifies the degree of mental impairment. Not only is the function of the glucose transporter impaired with Alzheimer's disease, but there is ample evidence that it is physically damaged as well. Doctors Arnold Scheibel, Taihong Duong, and Roland Jacob studied the microvessels from Alzheimer's patients with scanning electron microscopy. This allows the researcher to examine the vessels in 3D, and found that the capillary walls were irregularly swollen and distorted throughout their course in the brain. In a large number of Alzheimer's cases, they found that the capillaries looked like Swiss cheese. They concluded, "It is difficult to conceive that in a wall structure as physically distorted as this, the blood-brain barrier function could continue intact." In another study of microvessels taken from the brains of Alzheimer's patients, it was found that the capillaries were filled with a protein substance, causing the vessels to be congested and distorted. Yet when the microvessels from normal elderly persons were examined, they were found to be normal. Other studies have confirmed these findings. There is yet another bit of evidence for the failure of the blood-brain barrier in this disease, though less direct. It has been known for some time that Alzheimer's patients have a particular protein, called amyloid, within their brain tissue. This substance is not normally found within the brain and is not manufactured by it. Amyloid is a large protein, and under normal conditions is blocked from entry from the blood by way of the blood-brain barrier. Therefore, the only way it can enter the brain is by passing through the barrier, which would indicate that the barrier malfunctions in Alzheimer's disease. There is also evidence that glutamate itself can impair the entry of glucose into the brain. When mice were fed high doses of glutamate and then given radioactively labeled glucose so that it could be traced into the brain, researchers found that the glutamate lowered the amount of glucose allowed to enter the brain by 35%. This effect appears to be dose-related, that is, the larger the dose of glutamate, the greater the lowering of brain glucose. At very high concentrations of glutamate, brain glucose fell by as much as 64%. It would not be unreasonable to conclude that in a person with Alzheimer's disease, who already has impaired glucose transport, adding glutamate to their diet will only magnify the problem by further interfering with glucose transport into the brain. And as we have seen, with Alzheimer's disease, the brain is already trying to operate with severely limited energy supplies. Also, with an impaired blood-brain barrier, glutamate could enter the brain freely from the diet, thereby further endangering glutamate-type neurons that have already been made hypersensitive by energy depletion. Remember, energy-depleted neurons can be killed by even low doses of glutamate. There appears to be adequate evidence that because of damaged capillary walls and depleted glucose transporter in Alzheimer's disease, the brain, in essence, becomes hypoglycemic, and it can be hypoglycemic even when the blood sugar is normal. This is important to remember because most of us would assume that if we were hypoglycemic, we would have all the symptoms that go with it, such as weakness, trembling, severe hunger, and lightheadedness. But if only the brain is hypoglycemic, many of these symptoms, such as trembling and hunger, would be absent. If you have ever had a severe attack of hypoglycemia, you know well the feeling of confusion and disorientation that can occur. These are the same symptoms that occur with Alzheimer's disease. The difference is that with hypoglycemia, unless severe and prolonged, the symptoms are reversible once glucose is supplied to the brain. With malfunctioning of the glucose transporter, the brain would, in essence, remain hypoglycemic for extended periods of time. And with a defective barrier, high levels of glutamate could enter the brain and damage glutamate-sensitive neurons. Also, in the face of brain energy supplies, these neurons would be even more sensitive to excitotoxin damage and eventual death. With the normal 3 meals a day and frequent MSG-tainted snacks and aspartate-sweetened drinks and desserts, blood glutamate levels can remain dangerously high. The importance of prolonged elevations of blood excitotoxin levels was demonstrated in the experiments of Eugene Toth and Abel Leitha, who studied the effects of chronic administration of several amino acids on brain levels of these supposedly excluded substances. They found that by keeping blood levels of glutamate and aspartate elevated in rats, brain levels of these excitotoxins could be increased as much as 30% to 60%. This is a significant increase, especially under conditions where neurons are made energy deficient. They concluded from their study that while the brain is able to exclude certain amino acids when elevated for short periods of time, it cannot when these amino acids are elevated for long periods of time, as would be the case when excitotoxin taste enhancers are added to foods and drinks. It is important to note that this study was done in animals having a normal, intact blood-brain barrier. Defective energy production in Alzheimer's neurons. Thus far, we have seen that there are conditions associated with Alzheimer's disease that impair the delivery of energy-giving glucose to the brain. We have also seen that in the case of Parkinson's disease, metabolic energy defects have been identified with the specific neurons responsible for this disease. Similar findings have been demonstrated in the case of Alzheimer's disease. For example, there is evidence that one important energy enzyme within the mitochondria, called cytochrome oxidase, is deficient in the brain tissue of most Alzheimer's patients studied. The enzyme deficient in Parkinson's disease is called complex 1, and the deficiency in Alzheimer's disease is of complex 4. Both enzymes are part of the electron transport system, which generates most of the ATP energy molecules in the cell. In 1985, Dr. Quanfu Rex Xu and his co-workers demonstrated that there is another important energy-producing enzyme deficient in Alzheimer's disease. This vital energy enzyme, called pyruvate dehydrogenase, was not only deficient in badly damaged areas of the brain, but was extremely deficient in areas of the brain that appeared normal as well. It appears that this deficiency is an enzyme defect seen in all brain cells. But why would the equally energy-starved neurons within other areas of the brain be spared? The difference appears to lie in the fact that they contain very few glutamate-sensitive neurons, whereas the hippocampus, which is severely damaged in Alzheimer's disease, contains one of the highest densities of glutamate receptors in the entire brain. It is glutamate overstimulation that causes the energy-deficient neurons to be damaged in the first place. Some critics have charged that one would naturally expect enzymes to be deficient in areas of severely damaged brain, based purely on the fact that the cells have been damaged. But beside the fact that normal non-glutamate-sensitive brain neurons also have very low concentrations of the enzyme, even the severely damaged cells still have normal levels of the other mitochondrial enzymes. Therefore, it is not a general effect of neuron damage, but rather a specific and possibly primary cause of the energy failure of the neurons. There is also evidence that the defective energy-producing enzymes are not only found in brain cells, but are seen in other body tissues as well. In fact, over 40 studies have reported such defects in Alzheimer's patients. A recent study has disclosed another interesting deficiency in cellular energy production in Alzheimer's patients. In this study, it was found that neurons from the brains of patients dying with Alzheimer's disease were deficient in three particular types of energy-producing enzymes that are dependent on thiamine, vitamin B1, for their normal operation. These enzymes are called pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, transketolase, and ketoglutarate dehydrogenase complex. Vitamin B1 is attached to these enzymes and acts as a coenzyme or helper. These researchers studied several regions of the diseased brains and found that all three of these enzymes were dramatically reduced in all areas of the brain, but were so low as to be almost undetectable in the temporal lobe, the area of the brain most affected by Alzheimer's disease. Again, these enzymes were also extremely low in areas of the brain unaffected by Alzheimer's cellular injury, ruling out the possibility that the enzymes were low because of the injury itself. A loss of these three vital energy-producing enzymes correlates well with the observed decrease in the brain's oxidation of glucose seen with studies done on individuals with the disease. This is not to say that vitamin B1 can reverse the effects of this energy loss, because evidence so far indicates that feeding large doses of this vitamin to patients with Alzheimer's disease is of little benefit. Apparently, the injury to these enzymes is more serious than that seen with vitamin deficiencies alone. There is one other interesting finding regarding these three enzymes. It has been shown that when they are deficient, the normal metabolism of glutamate and its precursor, glutamine, is also deficient. This could possibly lead to an accumulation of dangerous levels of glutamate in the brain. It is known that patients with Alzheimer's disease in its early stages have a high rate of brain glucose metabolism in certain regions of the cortex. This would further confirm the finding of enzyme deficiencies within the energy production system of neurons, since such defects would cause more glucose to race through the impaired energy cycle in an effort to produce more energy. Similar hypermetabolism has been shown to occur in patients with Parkinson's disease. We have seen that in the face of low neuron energy levels, while the neuron is exposed to glutamate, the cell's protective systems will fail, causing a rapid and sustained flow of calcium into the inside of the neuron. This calcium influx then triggers a cascade of destructive reactions involving free radicals and prostaglandin products that will eventually kill the neuron. Studies of neurons damaged in the brains of Alzheimer's patients consistently demonstrate high levels of calcium within the damaged neurons and within the plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Remember also that experimentally, we can produce the very same neurofibrillary tangles merely by poisoning the energy-producing reactions in the mitochondria. These specific poisons block the electron transport chain, stopping the production of ATP by the cell. This process is called uncoupling. These experimentally produced tangles are antigenically the exact same material found in human cases of Alzheimer's disease. Further evidence of an energy deficit as the primary cause of this disease comes from the microscopic finding of distorted mitochondria within the typical plaques of Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Richard C. Henneberry and his co-workers found that when glutamate-type neurons are placed in cell culture and exposed to fairly high concentrations of glutamate in the presence of both glucose and magnesium, the cells remained normal. But when magnesium was removed and the glucose remained, the glutamate became a fairly potent toxin. When conditions were reversed, that is, glucose was removed and magnesium remained, the same dose of glutamate became an extremely potent toxin. It became obvious to these investigators that when the neuron was deficient in energy production, even normal to low doses of glutamate could become extremely toxic. Thus far, we have seen that there are several steps involved with energy production within the brain that are malfunctioning in Alzheimer's disease delivery of glucose to the blood-brain barrier, transport of glucose into the brain itself, and the actual production of ATP within the neuron. I have also demonstrated that under such energy-starved conditions, even low doses of glutamate can cause neuron injury and ultimately, if unrelieved, death. The same mechanism that injures the glucose transporter system also damages the blood-brain barrier itself. This could allow high levels of glutamate and aspartate to leak into the brain and spinal cord and cause widespread damage to the nervous system, ultimately resulting in one of the neurodegenerative diseases. While this scenario has not been proven, its component parts have been demonstrated experimentally, and several investigators have proposed this mechanism as a major contributing cause, if not the cause, of Alzheimer's disease. At this point, I want to emphasize that I am not making the claim that food-borne excitotoxins are the primary and only cause of Alzheimer's disease, or that by avoiding food-borne excitotoxins, one can totally prevent or arrest the disease. So far, the bulk of the evidence points to excitotoxins manufactured within the brain itself, in conjunction with neuron energy failure, as the primary culprit in this disease. But high levels of dietary excitotoxins, such as MSG and aspartate, could greatly aggravate the condition and cause it to progress more rapidly. And it may be that some cases of the disease are precipitated by glutamate and other excitotoxins in the diet. For example, elderly persons having had strokes and hypertension would be at great risk of developing brain damage from food additive excitotoxins. This remains to be proved. We do know, for example, that glutamate can damage the mitochondria of neurons and that it can produce the very same plaques and neurofibrillary tangles seen with Alzheimer's disease. Also, as I have shown, glutamate circulating in the blood has been demonstrated to impair the passage of glucose into the brain. This would make the brain hypoglycemic, energy starved, even when the blood sugar was normal. So, eating foods high in excitotoxin additives throughout the day could produce a condition that would make the brain vulnerable to even low doses of glutamate.